Stefan, welcome to SBS Radio's Armenian program.
Thank you for having me.
First, about you and your interest. You are a German historian, studied in Britain and currently teach in Haifa?
Yeah, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. What subjects do you teach at Haifa University?
Well, I'm doing various topics of German and European history and often on how it is connected and entangled with the Middle East. At the moment, I'm teaching a course on German history, for example. I did something on the prehistory of the Holocaust, talking about colonial genocide and the Armenian genocide, for example. And, these are my topics at the moment.
Stefan, on April 24 this year, you were the keynote speaker during the commemoration ceremony of the Armenian genocide in Jerusalem. What was the topic of your lecture?
I talked about how the Armenian genocide can be understood as paradigmatic for the 20th century. I've developed this idea in other places as well. I think the way the Armenian genocide was treated internationally and in its aftermath can be seen as the original sin of the 20th century. As I describe in my research as well, the fact that the perpetrators of genocide were allowed to go unpunished in the aftermath sent quite a signal around the world and also to Germany, the far right and the Nazis. But I also talked about how, this turning to killing one's own citizens during World War I can be understood as something new, something that marks the beginning of a new age that we're living in, I think, still today, probably.
Stefan, your book, Atatürk in the Nazi Imagination, it's been a few years since it was published. How it was received from academic circles and the Turks themselves?
Well, the reception was very interesting. It was received very well, much broader and much more positively than I would have expected. This goes for the academic community as well as in Turkey. The book was translated into Turkish and was published there quite fast after it was published in English. It's already in its second edition, and it received a lot of positive reviews in Turkey itself, which might surprise us, but there are many people working on the legacy of Atatürk's time and its international connections. And I think it was interesting for a broad range of people working on such topics.
When did you realize Nazis had a real fascination about Atatürk and there is enough material to write a book?
Well, actually, I came across the topic by coincidence, by mistake, when I was doing my graduate studies. I found some articles in Third Reich newspapers about Turkey. And it was very surprising that they were all positive. At the time, in the 1930s, there were a lot of theories and developments in Turkey itself about how the Turks were in a specific historical line, were connected to the first language ever spoken to humans, the so-called sun language theory, and many other very, strange theories. And I was interested what the Nazis did with this, if they saw some kind of competition with the Turks who laid claim to being, something at the origin of the human species, if the Nazis made perhaps fun of these Turkish theories. And then I found out that they didn't make fun of the Turks, quite the opposite. All the articles I could find already then were overtly positive and glorifying of whatever was happening in Turkey. And then starting from this, I wanted to look further. Where does it come from? What does it mean? What were the motivations behind it? And all this led me to the early 1920s, the aftermath of World War I, and the fascination I describe in my book there.
So what they admired in Atatürk, his personality, the way he ruled, or the way he stood up to the Western powers?
It's a mix. It starts with the end of World War I, and it starts with how the Turkish nationalists resisted the Entente attempts to divide up the Ottoman Empire. And it also rests upon a foundation of German thought and German discourses from the late 19th century onwards on how basically the Turkish element within the Ottoman Empire was perceived similar to the Germans and to German history, and how the Germans, more in general perhaps, kind of identified with the Turks. And then, World War I ends, and German nationalists feel helpless, impotent, vis-à-vis the Entente. They don't feel they can actually save the nation from the peace treaty of Versailles. They feel that their own politicians are not acting in the interests of the nation. And a lot of them call for armed action against the Entente and against their own government. And in this context, in the years from 1919 to 1923, the German press and the German nationalists, they look at what's happening in Turkey, and they're full with amazement and wonder on how the Turks, who they perceive to be in a much weaker position than themselves, the German nationalists, how the Turks are able to resist the Entente and then actually to do so successfully. And from this, you know, this constant gaze upon what is happening in Anatolia, the German newspapers, German nationalists at the time, they transform what they see in Turkey into lessons for Germany. And the Nazis are a big part of that. They also begin talking about Turkish lessons, and it all culminates in 1923, while the Turks are negotiating the new treaty, the Treaty of Lausanne, revising a Paris peace treaty. The German nationalists call for the application of Turkish lessons in Germany, and the Nazis call for basically replicating the idea of having a different seat of power, you know, the capital of Ankara of the nationalists facing the old capital in Istanbul by the still Ottoman government. And they say that Germany should do something similar and set up an alternative government in Munich and from there reconquer Germany. And that's kind of the idea that's behind the beer cellar putsch of 1923, where Hitler tried to actually seize power in Germany.
So this fascination with Atatürk happened during a specific period of time or continued even during World War II?
These are the roots, these first years after World War I. But it included so much more. It's not only standing up to the Entente, revisionism and strong nationalism. From the beginning, the German nationalists and far right, including the Nazis, they saw a lot of other attributes in Turkish nationalism and in Atatürk that they thought were honorable or should be copied. One thing was the strong leader figure of Atatürk, who could basically unify all different kind of nationalist elements behind him. Others were how to organize the army, an army of volunteers, getting rid of the minorities, and so on and so forth. And this continues in the Third Reich. In 1933, when the Nazis come to power, there are many instances where the Nazis actually kind of reconnect to their early 1920s glorification of Atatürk and the New Turkey, as they call it. And one prominent example is an interview that Hitler gives where he calls Atatürk his star in the darkness of the 1920s. And this fascination continues in the 1930s and includes all of these various elements, the Führer figure, the strong leader, a new nationalized and national economy, an ethnic state, and so on and so forth. It reaches a high point when Atatürk dies in 1938, and then relations between Germany and Turkey become a little bit more difficult, but the Nazis in their main publication are quite stubborn and continue to cling on to their glorification of Atatürk and the new Turkey.
In 1920s, were there German journalists in Turkey reporting about Atatürk?
Most of the news actually in the early 1920s reached Germany via Paris and London. After World War I, the German community had to leave Turkey, was part of the armistice clauses, and there was actually a time when the real relations between Germany and Turkey were at a historic low point. There was not even an embassy or consulate at the time in the early 1920s, and still, you know, at home, the fascination with Turkey and also the volume of articles in the press reached an all-time historic high point. So I think that's also interesting, you know, for historians to bear in mind. You know, actual relations can be very can be at a low point, while the fascination with another country can be something totally different.
This admiration was towards Atatürk only, or extended towards his circle, religion, Islam, and Turks in general?
Well, as as I said, there was this history of Germans identifying closely with the Turks, but mostly, basically, the movement of Turkish nationalism was mainly perceived as a leader-led movement. It was very much stylized on the person of Atatürk himself. They do mention İsmet İnönü in these articles and other people as well, but it all comes down to the leader for them. You know, your question about Islam, that's a more difficult question too. I believe, you know, that the later fascination of the Nazis with Islam basically comes from other topics and from other people than those talking about the Turks. There was a general fascination with Islam, but at the same time for Hitler himself, for example, the way Atatürk pushed Islam back from, you know, society was something actually the Nazis kind of wanted to copy for Germany as well, and they often compared Islam to Catholicism, Christianity in its Catholic form, of a supranational institution that often corrupts, in their view, national traditions and the national kind of feeling. So while there is some fascination with Islam as such in the Third Reich and among some Nazis, when it comes to Turkey itself, there's more admiration for the way Islam was controlled and curtailed by Atatürk than any sort of Muslim character of the Turks.
Hmm. And how Atatürk fitted into Nazi Aryan ideology?
Well, that's also a little bit difficult. I mean, there's always there are always these quotes where people say, and the literature in the time, in the 20s and 30s, sometimes stresses this as well, because of his complexion, because of his light hair and blue eyes, you know, he was considered by some Nazis and some authors in the interwar period as an example of an Aryan leader over his people. However, there's also different and other kind of racial perspectives on the Turks, and when the so-called Nuremberg Laws were promulgated, the Turkish government actually asked Third Reich officers what this meant for them. Were the Turks considered to be Aryan or not? And the Third Reich replied that this distinction, Aryan, non-Aryan, only applied internally in Germany. Externally, the distinction was to be European, non-European. And these officers of the Third Reich said because Turkey strove to be a European country and Germany supported Turkey in this development, Turkey, for all purposes, was considered to be a European country.
And when you became interested in the fate of Ottoman Armenians?
Well, this discussion about Atatürk, his policies, and this whole fascination of the Nazis always includes an ethnic component. When the Nazis in the Third Reich talk about the new Turkey as a model of a völkisch, of an ethnic state, they always talk about the role of ethnic minorities, and when they talk about the new Turkey as a success story, they always talk about a post-genocidal country. And I realized, you know, that even though the Nazis do not talk much about the Armenian genocide and the Armenians in general, it's always part of this story. And when I did my research for my last book, Justifying Genocide, I tried to reconstruct Germany's history with the Armenians going back a little bit further than just the Nazis. And I went back to start in the late 19th century. And there you can see there is a longer tradition that precedes the Nazis. Actually, two longer traditions. One is more political and the other one is more connected to racial thought. The Germans viewed the Armenians already from the late 19th century as something parallel to the Jews of Europe. And you can make the argument that modern racial anti-Semitism and German anti-Armenianism developed at the same time and became important at the same time, most markedly so in the 1890s. And in these racial discourses that develop and that are constantly redefined and reprinted and redeveloped in the 1920s, also in the 1930s again, the Armenians have a very specific role, and it's very close to the role that the Jews have in these discourses. And then, as I said, there's also a political tradition. Germany wanted the Ottoman Empire as a friend, later as an ally, and at the same time also wanted to use the Ottoman Empire as kind of a diversion from problems within Europe. And for both these interests, it was important for Germany that the Ottoman Empire in some form continued to exist, and the Armenians were also always a troublesome point for the Germans in this policy, and this most markedly so in the 1890s with the Hamidian massacres of the Armenians, where it becomes difficult for Germany to continue to be a friend of the Ottoman Empire while at the same time knowing about these massacres as they go on. And in these debates in the 1890s already, you can see that there are two different forces in the German public and public opinion. Ones who try to educate Germany about what is happening to the Armenians, the massacres in progress. After all, it took some years for them to come to a close, and German public opinion reacted to these. And then there is more pro-government and pro-Turkish circles who try to at first downplay what is happening to the Armenians, and then actually, when they cannot downplay it anymore, try to justify what is happening to the Armenians. And this is in the 1890s, and it plays out again in the early 1920s when Germany discusses the Armenian genocide. And then actually you have a large debate in which pro-Turkish voices not only justify some sort of actions against the Armenians, but at some point actually outright justify genocide.
During World War One, Germans and Turks were allies. Was there a censorship in Germany and Germans didn't know what was happening to the Armenians?
That's a difficult question. In the past, other researchers have suggested that, you know, there was such a form of censorship that Germans couldn't know anything about what was happening to the Armenians. I looked at the newspapers of World War One again and at the debates and how they played out. And it is true that the German public could not know the full extent of what was happening, but especially in the summer of 1915, there was so much debate about the Armenians, about the deportations, and about Armenian victims and violence against the Armenian in these deportations, and that the German newspaper reader at the time could have understood that something more than just wartime deportations was happening. And especially so because the Entente issued a series of declarations, the House of Lords in Britain discussed the Armenian topic, and the German press and propaganda responded to them in such a fierce way that, you know, it was obvious that something very important and something shocking was going on, actually. But World War One was difficult. There were a lot of propaganda topics. There was constantly talk of atrocities, crimes against civilians. It was perhaps difficult to understand the full extent. After World War One, however, as I show in my book and as I found out in my research, there was actually something like a true genocide debate, and I actually argue it was a great genocide debate stretching for almost 4 years in the German public and centered around the Armenian genocide.
On that topic, did the killing of Talat and the Tehlirian's trial help the discussion?
It did, to a very large extent. The debate, this genocide debate, starts in 1919. The Germans are dealing with a lot of topics and a lot of problems, and you would perhaps imagine then that they didn't have really the energy and the time to talk about what happened in Anatolia, in the Ottoman Empire during World War One, but as the world was in session in Paris and negotiating a peace treaty for Germany, German officers, especially the Foreign Office, was afraid that what had happened to the Armenians would be used against Germany as well. As you might well know, already during World War One, a lot of Entente voices speculated that Germany was actually behind the Armenian genocide. And so in 1919 already, the German Foreign Office tasked Johannes Lepsius, the most important pro-Armenian activist, I would argue, of the last decades. He started already to work in the 1890s to educate Germany and the Western world about what was happening to the Armenians. In 1919, the German Foreign Office asked him to edit a volume of documents from its own correspondence from the diplomats serving in the Ottoman Empire on the Armenian topic, in order to show that Germany actually helped the Armenians and tried to stop the Armenian genocide. So this publication was already put out in 1919. That's very extraordinary, because this German Foreign Office wanted to impact on the Entente and on the negotiations in Paris. It didn't convince the world abroad much. They actually saw it as more proof that Germany didn't help the Armenians. But at home, it started a first debate about the Armenian genocide. German newspapermen were shocked and wrote long editorials about what they read in this volume, and they cited extensively from the reports. And many of these editorials and newspaper articles already in 1919 clearly established that what had happened to the Armenians was what we call today genocide. In the language of the time, it was called a murder of a people, the annihilation or destruction of a whole people. And for all these debates, it was clear that there was intent to kill a whole people, very much fitting later definitions of genocide. But this debate didn't last long. There was some response from the far right and pro-Turkish circles. And then by 1921 and by 1920, the topic already kind of petered out slowly. And it came back when Talat Pasha was assassinated in early 1921 in Berlin. And especially the topic became a real topic again when Solomon Telerian was acquitted by a Berlin jury in the summer of 1921. This trial and its outcome truly shocked the German public. And then for many weeks and even months to come, German newspapers tried to understand what had happened there. And in doing so, again, unfolded the whole horrors of the Armenian genocide and discussed it broadly, cited from both the Foreign Office publication of 2 years prior, but also from the trial itself, from the various testimonies, and so on. This was truly the high point of this debate, and it even swayed those on the far right or on the right to far right spectrum who previously tried to minimize what had happened to the Armenians. From the late summer of 1921 onwards, there was basically no printed public opinion outlet anymore that denied this charge of murder against the nation. And interestingly enough, perhaps, the far right, who had previously minimized what had happened to the Armenians, now actually, like they did before, justified what had happened to the Armenians. And this is kind of this culminating point of the German discourses around the Armenians. At this point, the far right newspapers in Germany justified genocide. And not only in the Armenian cases as during World War I, but some of them even elevated it to a level where genocide as such could be justifiable, could be a policy option, if you will.
Stefan, many European countries, Britain, France, and also Australia here, found a common ground and sympathized with Armenians because of the Christian religion. Why this common denominator didn't work for Germans?
Yeah, that's indeed a very interesting observation. And it's quite puzzling, actually, when you look at these discourses. And again, you can go back to the 1890s already. The Christianity, you could say, of the Armenians was kind of a problem for these discourses dealing with the Armenians and the Ottoman Empire and the violence against the Armenians. And already in the 1890s, you can see that the Armenians' Christianity becomes less and less a topic or a point of information or a point of sympathy as time goes on. It is rather politics, realpolitik, as they call it, politics and the nation kind of trumped religious consideration. And it's very interesting to see that from early on, there is not much of a basically pan-Christian sympathy towards the Armenians. However, there are Christian circles, and especially Protestant circles in Germany in the 1890s onward, that are very active in educating Germany about what's happening to the Armenians, in collecting money for the Armenians. And mentioned Johannes Lepsius, this pro-Armenian activist, he comes from Protestant religious circles. He was a pastor, as were many others working for the Armenians. But even they, a lot of times, do not make very much of the Armenians' Christianity. And it's interesting to see how by the 1920s, the fact that they are Christians doesn't matter much. And Soman Tilirian was a Protestant Christian, even on trial in the heart of Protestant Germany in Berlin. And his Christianity, his Protestantism, is not even a topic in these debates at all. So the Armenians' Christianity becomes a non-topic early on, and I think these racial discourses, which kind of put the Armenians parallel to the Jews and the Jewish problem as it was perceived by nationalists and the far right in Germany, this becomes much more important in these discourses about the Armenians and the Armenian genocide.
On another matter, on several occasions when, for example, Peter Balakian and Taner Akçam came to Melbourne, functions were held in the Jewish Museum in Melbourne. And on those occasions, many survivors of the Holocaust recounted their memories of the extermination of Armenians from Franz Werfel's book. Do you know how the book was perceived by the Nazis and how it influenced the Jewish communities in occupied Europe?
Yeah, that's also part of my book and my approach in this book, Justifying Genocide. Franz Werfel is indeed not only very interesting for our story and for this history and for the connection between the two genocides, the Armenian genocide and the Holocaust, but he's much more. He offers us a prism into how this world perceived what was happening to the Jews in the Third Reich and in World War II was actually connected to the Armenian genocide. Franz Werfel, he actually wrote his famous book, The 40 Days of Musadar, as a warning to Germany and against Hitler. He says in private correspondence and his notes that he actually used the Armenians as his, quote, stand-in Jews. And he tries, through this story and through the history of the Armenian genocide, to warn Germany what could happen if the Nazis and Hitler came to power. He only finished it in late 1933, but already the winter before, in 32 to 33, when in Germany it was becoming clear that Hitler might actually come to power, Werfel was touring Germany on a reading tour, reading his first excerpts from his book to German audiences, and we have at least one article in the German press debating his reading lecture, and where it becomes clear that the audience understood that when Werfel is reading from his famous chapter in which Johannes Lepsius meets Enver Pasha during World War One, that actually Johannes Lepsius is not speaking to Enver Pasha but to the German audience, and is full with warning and foresight into what is happening. The book was published in Germany in late 1933, and astonishingly some copies were allowed to go out to subscribers of the publishing house's series. Then it was later outlawed by the Nazis, but in the meantime it has been translated not only into English but also into Polish and Hebrew and many other languages. And after World War II started, we know that Franz Werfel's book was one of the most read books in the Nazi-imposed ghettos of Eastern Europe, and we have many testimonies on how Jewish readers suffering under the Nazis in these ghettos awaiting their further plight actually identify with the Armenians in Franz Werfel's stories. Some readers find the story and its message very depressing. They talk about how if nobody came to save the Armenians, how nobody would come to save the Jews of Europe. Others, however, were inspired by the resistance at Musadar by the Armenians. And we know that the ghetto resistance in Bialystok and also in Warsaw was greatly inspired by Franz Werfel and by actually the Armenian resistance on Musadar during World War One.
Stefan, moving to more modern times, how do you interpret the current relations between Germany and Turkey?
Here again, there is both current interest and current politics and also a longer tradition. German-Turkish relations remain very close, and in the past they have weathered many difficult times. It remains to be seen how all this plays out at the moment. Germany and Turkey are not only connected through various political and economic ties, but also, of course, through the population in Germany with a Turkish background. And I think German politics always has to tread very carefully between, you know, the interests it has vis-a-vis its own populations at home and vis-a-vis Turkey abroad. These are very difficult times, both for Turkey and for Germany. And we will see how this further plays out. But I think we can safely assume that many Turks will find refuge in Germany in the coming years.
What's your view on the current political situation and changes in Turkish politics and the gradual dismantling of the legacy of Atatürk?
It's not easy to offer fast and easy answers here. I think we were all shocked by the drive of Erdogan's government to entrench itself in the political system, also in the long run and in long-term perspective. Yeah, I can only say that it's very sad that we, as the international community, did not find a better way to protect free speech in Turkey in these last years. It remains to be seen where Erdogan will take Turkey with this new entrenchment and changes to the constitution. And it's very difficult to see kind of a long-term trajectory here, but it will be very difficult with all the destruction of free speech that has already taken place over the last years.
Stefan, it was a pleasure talking to you. I hope we see you in Australia.
I hope so too. It was a pleasure talking to you too. Thank you so much.